At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from KeyBank Capital Markets, specializing in corporate and investment banking solutions for established and growing mid-sized companies. Visit key.com/KBCM. And by Society for Human Resource Management, HR, leading people, leading organizations, shrm.org. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937, Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Most of the economic news that's fit to air today comes from Washington. The Senate's agreed to do something about mortgages. Ben Bernanke spent a couple of hours explaining the economy to Congress, and we'll talk about new rules for the financial markets. Housing, Bernanke, regulations, oh my! From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Shriners Hospitals for Children, providing treatment for orthopedic, burn, and spinal cord injuries at no cost to the families. More at ShrinersForKids.org. And by Advanta. Advanta salutes small business, the brave ones, the risk takers, all those who chase a dream and make their own way.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you with us on this Wednesday. It is the 2nd of April today, and we're going to do housing first, since it's still happening. The news comes from the Senate side of the Capitol building, where both parties are tripping over themselves, trying to show how much they agree with each other for a change. Late yesterday afternoon, we learned there was a tentative deal to help homeowners struggling with mortgages they can't afford anymore. Senate leaders had said they'd have a deal by noon today. That's taken a lot longer than anybody's expected, even though negotiations went on through the night last night. From Washington, Jeremy Hobson reports. Now it's time to debate and amend.
This is the view from the Republican side, courtesy of Senator Norm Coleman.
We've done something today that the American people should be very proud of.
And this is the view from the Democratic side. Here's Senator Bill Nelson.
This bill that's before us provides some common sense relief.
The compromise package will include money for counseling for people at risk of losing their homes, an overhaul of the Federal Housing Administration, and incentives for communities and citizens alike to buy foreclosed properties to prevent a free fall in the value of the homes around them. Andrew Jakobovics of the Center for American Progress says reducing the inventory of vacant housing is key.
We think it's sort of far easier to protect the equity that most Americans have built up in their homes than trying to figure out how to gain it back over the long term.
Democrats will likely have to give up on one proposal they've been pushing. It would allow bankruptcy judges to alter the terms of existing mortgages. Lenders and the White House said that would drive up the cost of loans for everyone. So overall, is the compromise a big enough fix? Jim Carr of the National Community Reinvestment Coalition says no.
If we don't get much more substantial proposals on the table and this continues to drift into September, October, then it certainly will be too late for millions of more households.
He says millions more because of this daunting figure, 2 million. That's the number of Americans expected to lose their homes by the end of next year. In Washington, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
I don't know if the senators talking about housing were paying any attention, but the chairman of the Federal Reserve gave Congress a poke in the eye today. Ben Bernanke spent his morning with the Joint Economic Committee, and we'll get to the meat of what he said in just a second. But at one point, he was asked why the Fed hadn't done more to fix the housing crisis. Here's what he said.
Well, the Federal Reserve was acting in its sphere of influence to address financial issues. As I've said, I think housing is very important, and we need to address it. But, of course, that's the Congress's sphere of influence, not the Fed's.
Not my job, right? On the question of what's going to happen with the economy, his answer was fairly predictable.
Our estimates are that we're slightly growing at the moment, but we think that there's a chance that for the first half as a whole, there might be a slight contraction.
The Fed chief said a recession is possible, but he wouldn't take the bait when lawmakers asked about more rate cuts. He got some questions about Bear Stearns, too, and the $29 billion the Fed put up to help J.P. Morgan buy out its troubled competition.
We did not bail out Bear Stearns.
Might have been the most emotion he showed all day.
Anybody who wants to borrow for a mortgage, for a house, or for other purposes, anyone who has an investment account with stocks and other assets in it, anyone whose company wants to acquire capital to expand employment needs to have a healthy, functioning financial system. What we did, always in my mind, was that what was the best thing for the American public?
Bernanke didn't say it outright, but one of the reasons the Fed helped stop Bear Stearns from going under, Bear was heavily involved in a peculiar kind of financial instrument called credit default swaps. They made the bank not too big to fail, but through those swaps too intertwined with the rest of the financial system for the Fed to take the risk of its failing, trillions of dollars worth. Let me take you back to yesterday's show and a conversation I had with Bob Moon about default swaps.
They were invented a few years back so banks and bondholders, the investors, could make sure that they got paid back when companies failed to pay their loans. So in a way, you could call this insurance.
One thing Bob and I didn't talk much about was how those swaps are going to be regulated under the new rules Henry Paulson proposed on Monday. Right now, they're not at all. Marketplace's John Dimsdale is on the regulatory beat for us in Washington. Hiya, John.
Hello, Kai.
Let's start, I suppose, with what the situation is right now. What does Treasury Secretary Paulson propose to do about credit default swaps?
Well, he only deals with it very generally. His plan would give the Federal Reserve Board broad jurisdiction over investment banks. It would allow the Fed to look at these banks' exposure to potential defaults by borrowers, pull the investment banks back from the brink of too much risk. But it's a very light regulatory touch. Remember, Henry Paulson was chief executive of Goldman Sachs. He's very much a part of the Wall Street investment world that fought really hard to keep these credit swaps unregulated the last time there was a major reform of the banking world.
What are you hearing, though, the buzz in Washington about people maybe going off the Treasury reservation and talking about actually doing something about these things?
Yes, there's lots of talk of a much more aggressive government regulation of this of these credit swaps. Robert Rubin, President Clinton's Treasury Secretary, has proposed treating credit insurance policies the same way stocks and bonds are regulated. That means licensing traders, just like stockbrokers, requiring that traders have reserves to cover sales or defaults. I talked to one former regulator who warns that, you know, setting up government oversight isn't going to be easy. Michael Greenberger was at the Commodity Futures Trading Commission in 2000, back when Congress deregulated credit swaps. And Greenberger says that the investment banks are going to lobby extremely hard against any attempt to make the government a market referee.
Wall Street wants to tell you, oh, this is too complicated for you. Only we can understand this. They're not that complicated. And by the way, these guys who are so bright are losing billions and billions of dollars hand over fist. They don't understand what they're doing.
So, John, here we are. By my count, it's 3 days, 2 days, actually, since the Treasury Secretary formally made his announcement. And already we're talking about other things that are going to happen in the world of regulation. How long is it going to take to get anything done?
You know, major banking reforms like this take years. One problem in imposing regulations is that this credit swaps market is bigger than the stock market now. These swaps have been repackaged and resold so many times that they've permeated through the entire economy. Credit swaps are in pension funds, money market funds, endowments. Just finding them, much less putting a value on them, will be difficult.
So sadly, we are not done talking about them yet, are we?
Not at all, unless, of course, some sort of financial meltdown forces Congress's hands. And that always has a way of concentrating the minds around here.
Yes, it does. John Dimsdale at the Marketplace Bureau in Washington. Thank you, John.
Thank you, Kai.
One more thing from yesterday before we go too much further. That whole bit about the IRS and air conditioners instead of rebate checks, yeah, it was a joke. Sorry if we fooled you, but thanks for playing along all the same. On Wall Street today, not much, actually. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The Asian Development Bank offered a less rosy outlook than usual today. The bank says the Asian economy is looking at its slowest period of growth in 5 years. Slow, but still a healthy 7.5% rise overall. The bank's chief economist said commodity prices are fueling inflation there, and that economies like China's are going to be closely tied to what are called the G3. That's the U.S., the Eurozone, and Japan for some time to come. Commentator David Frum says that's true now more than ever.
A lot of investors are betting that the price of oil, wheat, and other commodities will stay high for some time to come. The bet certainly seems to make sense. With tens of millions of Chinese and Indians joining the developed world, demand for basic commodities should boom and keep booming. A generation ago, China ranked 20th among world oil importers. Today, it stands second. But commodity bulls ought to consider this question. Can China prosper if the United States slumps? Probably no major economy has ever depended so much on one partner as China now depends on the United States. 80% of China's GDP derives from international trade. And the United States is far and away the top destination for Chinese merchandise exports. Between 2001 and 2005, Chinese exports to the United States grew at a rate of almost 30% per year. But what happens if that rate of growth slows? If Americans buy fewer electronic products, fewer running shoes, less glassware and dinnerware, Chinese households, in turn, must cut back their purchases of new apartments, new cars, and new and costlier foods. It's not just the household sector that will be affected. Much of America's uncertain mortgage debt is owned by Chinese investors. The state-owned Bank of China says it owns $5 billion of subprime loans. And that's on top of billions more of Chinese domestic bad debt. Some experts estimate that about half of all loans held by Chinese banks have ceased to pay interest. Bad debt imperils the credit that builds the gleaming new towers and airports of Shanghai and Beijing. And if those towers and airports stop going up, so too will the prices of the steel, copper, and other materials of which they are made. It was Napoleon Bonaparte who first observed that China's rise would shake the earth. But always remember, it is America's ups and downs that shake China.
David Frum is a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. His latest book is called Comeback, Conservatism That Can Win Again. Send us your thoughts at our website. It's marketplace.org. Click on the link that says contact. Surveys show American workers like creative labor arrangements, telecommuting, flex time, things like that. But as the economy slows, some employers are reconsidering. The state of Ohio recently changed the rules of the game for its 60,000 employees. And as of next month, flex time is not going to be so flexible anymore. From WCPN in Cleveland, Mari Saito reports.
Walking around state offices in Columbus, Ohio, Hugh Quill noticed more empty desks on Fridays. So the director of the state's Department of Administrative Services called a meeting with union stewards on a Friday afternoon.
It sounds like it was Machiavellian, but it really wasn't. I just had an opening at Friday at 2 o'clock, and it was actually kind of funny, though, when the person stated that it's the first Friday he'd been at work in 13 years, that I said, welcome back.
Thousands of Ohio state workers have used alternative work schedules for over 15 years. At the request of Democratic Governor Ted Strickland, Quill is overhauling the system. Telecommuting from home and working 40 hours in fewer days are pretty much out. It's all part of a larger plan, Quill says, to make sure government workers, including cabinet heads like him, maximize their efficiency. Ohio is facing a budget crisis, and every dollar counts right now.
Performance management has been a real focus here, especially in a state that has so many challenges as the state of Ohio does. You know, it really makes it all the more important to get all the bang for their buck that a taxpayer can get from their state services.
According to the U.S. Department of Labor, about one quarter of full-time employees in both the state and private sectors nationally are on flexible work schedules. As the economy tightens, some flexible work advocates say Ohio's plan to change flex time arrangements could be a canary in the coal mine.
And I would hope that they would let some air in for the canary.
Ellen Galinsky heads the nonprofit Families and Work Institute.
That the solution is not to say that everyone has to be there from 8 to 5, but to say, how can we reinvent flexibility so that it works for the state, so that there aren't gaps in coverage, and so that it works for employees.
Peter Ray is with the Ohio Civil Service Employees Association. He says the union has gotten dozens of complaints from both workers and managers, and he says the new rules are a step backwards. They unfairly penalize those workers who never interact with the public.
When the public hears this about public employees griping about having to go to work 8 to 5, there's understandably concern of whether or not, you know, public workers are asking for too much. But the reality is this does not involve those that they tend to see. These are pretty much behind-the-scenes employees.
Marcia Collins is one of those people. She works as a clerk. The single mom was working 7 to 3:30 to be home after school for her child with special needs. Now her hours are 8 to 4:30, and she's asking friends to pick up her son from the school bus.
Oh, this is going to be hard because now I have to base every day something could come up. So now I'm not guaranteed every day I'm going to be in the office because I never know for sure if someone's going to be there to get my son every day.
Managers like Hugh Quill say flexible work hours are still available at the discretion of department heads. But Marcia Collins was just denied, she says, because her office didn't need anyone to come in before 8 a.m. In Cleveland, I'm Mari Saito for Marketplace.
Coming up, buying booze in the Bible Belt.
It was a total shock to have the wine taken away and, you know, being treated like a 14-year-old as if I was, you know, trying to get drunk with my parents gone over the weekend.
But first, let's do the numbers. Mr. Bernanke's gray forecast helps send the blue chips back into the red today. Push the Dow Industrials down 45 points, a third of 1% to 12,608. The Nasdaq shaved off a point, ending basically flat at 2361. The S&P 500 deducted 2 points. That's a tenth of 1%, closed at 1367 there. Among the biggest drags on the major indices, IBM lost 1.5%. General Electric shares gave up 1%. Don't ask why, because your guess is as good as ours, but investors have been raising the roof on home builders. Reuters reports its index of home builders has now gained almost 30% so far this year. Case in point, KB Homes rose nearly 4% today. ExxonMobil spurted higher by 1.75%. ConocoPhillips rose 1.33%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Cargill. Collaborate, create, succeed. This is how Cargill works with customers. Stories online at CargillCreates.com. By Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals, institutions, and advisors reach their long-term financial goals. 888 Vanguard. And the Society for Human Resource Management, HR, leading people, leading organizations. Online at shrm.org. Every day's marketplace is put together the day of. If you want to get the show info as it's being created, sign up for the Marketplace Midday Update. It also includes upcoming special projects on the show. Go to marketplace.org and click on the newsletter link.
On the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. President Bush is in Bucharest attending the three-day NATO summit. In Washington, the House Transportation and Infrastructure Committee discusses FAA safety oversight of airlines. And long before instant messaging and email, there was the Pony Express. On April 3rd, 1860, the first carriers hopped in the stirrups to deliver letters across country. Cost? $5 for every half ounce of mail. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The immigration debate in Arizona is one of the most contentious in the country, in part because it has some of the most severe restrictions on illegal aliens. At the beginning of the year, a new and controversial law went into effect there. It obliges businesses to verify the immigration status of new hires or face heavy sanctions, up to and including the loss of their business licenses. The law is stuck in court, and late yesterday, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce filed a brief asking judges to overturn it. From the America's Desk at WLRN, Marketplace's Dan Gretsch reports.
The Arizona law requires businesses to use a federal database called E-Verify to establish a worker as legal. But E-Verify is an optional pilot program. Attorney Robin Conrad with the U.S. Chamber of Commerce says making the system mandatory is unconstitutional.
Some states are frustrated, but the fact of the matter is that they don't have the authority to do what they're doing.
Conrad says states can't be allowed to continue writing immigration law.
It's creating a piecemeal approach to this issue, a national patchwork, which is quite onerous for companies, particularly those that operate in a multi-state environment.
It's also taking a toll on small businesses. Brett Winger runs two tea houses in Phoenix. Four recent hires went through E-Verify smoothly, but one woman was a no match.
She kind of freaked out a little bit. Meanwhile, all these clocks start running and there's all these processes that you have to do as an employer. So if I had to go through this process of non-match a lot, I would probably just quit hiring people and do the work myself.
Economists in Arizona say the law is prompting workers to leave and slowing growth in the state. Julie Pace is one of the attorneys challenging the law.
Our neighboring states are very happy right now. I know California is cheering us on in Nevada because it's helping them grow.
So far, the lower courts have ruled in favor of Arizona. A decision from the Court of Appeals is expected in the fall. I'm Dan Gretsch for Marketplace.
Most of us don't really care how our spreadsheets or Word documents work, so long as they do. But then they hit our inboxes, and that warning pops up telling us we don't have the file formats we need to open them. Right about there, you start cursing Microsoft, mostly because that's the easiest thing to do. But this week, the international group that decides these things made Microsoft's Office 2007 file format the world standard. From the Marketplace Innovations Desk at North Carolina Public Radio, Janet Babin tells us what the heck that means and why it matters.
The decision means we'll all probably worry less about our electronic data. Martin LaMonica with CNetNews.com says preserving old files can be a guessing game, especially for big companies and governments.
What happens if Microsoft goes away? What happens if Microsoft stops supporting that one file format that the country of Denmark chose, you know, a long time ago?
Upgrading can get expensive. The decision by the International Organization for Standardization will let software developers create programs that work better with Microsoft Office. But the decision also makes Microsoft more attractive to customers who prefer ISO-certified goods. Critics charge that Microsoft pressured governments to vote in its favor. Marino Marsic is with an alliance that created a format called Open Document. He says the ISO decision gives Microsoft Office a competitive edge.
Control of the format is really the key to the $15 billion Office enterprise. And Microsoft is hell-bent on controlling that format.
But a few years ago, the ISO approved the Open Document format.
There's a saying in the information technology business that the greatest thing about standards is there's so many of them. And in many ways, this sort of makes a mockery of the standard-setting process.
That's editor David Berlin at Information Week. He says the two standards, Microsoft's and Open Document, could stall innovation because software developers won't know which format to support. I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
Say you're throwing a Sunday afternoon barbecue. You're behind on your shopping, so you run out that day to the store. You've got burgers and dogs on the list, maybe some potato salad, and without question, a couple of 12-packs of beer. If you live in Georgia, though, you can forget the suds because blue laws are still on the books there, which means no Sunday alcohol sales. But this week, lawmakers passed a bill that would let wine be sold over the Internet, and there's a bill pending to allow Sunday sales. That has in turn given hope to some Georgians looking to wet their whistles on a weekend. Georgia Public Broadcasting's Susanna Capilouto has the story.
When Russ Flett was transferred to Atlanta from L.A. 7 years ago, he ran into a common problem.
Absolute culture shock. I was feared being arrested the first time I came here because I was shopping on a Sunday.
Flett had two bottles of wine in his shopping cart that day. When he got to the register, they were confiscated by the cashier.
It was a total shock to have the wine taken away and, you know, being treated like a 14-year-old as if I was, you know, trying to get drunk with my parents gone over the weekend.
Flat has learned his lesson, and this past Sunday at a Kroger grocery in Midtown Atlanta, his cart was alcohol-free. Alcohol was on the mind of shopper Mark Cohen. He was a rare visitor to the dark, abandoned wine aisle of the store.
Just to see if they had a specific brand of Pinot in. It's called Domaine Serene. It's from Oregon.
Is your wine here?
Oh, yes, yes. But I can't purchase it today.
Cohen could not complete his $30 purchase because Georgia is only one of three states in the nation, along with Indiana and Connecticut, where alcohol can't be sold in stores on Sundays. If you want to drink, you'll have to find a restaurant. The law is a remnant of Prohibition-era blue laws and still treasured by Christian conservatives, including State Senator Eric Johnson of Savannah.
I think we've just been continuing to chip away at the Sabbath, and that's my personal faith. I just don't think there's any reason.
Sunday was once revered as a day of rest and prayer in the Bible Belt South. But Georgia has had an unprecedented influx of people and economic growth in recent years. And Sunday is now the busiest shopping day of the week in many markets, says Jay Hibbert, with the Distilled Spirits Council of the United States.
The market basket on Sunday is, in fact, bigger than it is almost every other day. And so it's in a two-income family, Sunday is sometimes the only opportunity they have to do their shopping.
Hibbert says Georgia loses anywhere from $30 to $40 million in liquor sales to neighboring states and in lost sales to impulse buyers each year. A repeal of the ban, he says, could bring up to $5 million in tax revenue for the state. The grocery industry has at least three lobbyists at the state capitol. They want to let voters in each county decide whether to lift the Sunday sales ban. The biggest detractor, however, is Georgia Governor Sonny Perdue. He is not a drinker and a proud Christian.
6 days is plenty to gather up. We've got refrigerators. You've got different places to store. I think we need a little relief on Sunday.
The fridge at Jason Randall's home was stocked with alcohol this past Sunday for a get-together to watch March Madness. The PhD student planned ahead and made his beer run on Saturday.
I was out and about yesterday, and I was like, well, tomorrow is Sunday, and so let me go and make a stop. A stop I wouldn't normally make if it was sold on Sundays, of course, but just to stock up to make sure I had enough for today.
Georgia residents like Randall have learned to live with the restrictions. However, over 50,000 people have signed an online petition to end the blue laws. Governor Perdue's tenure is up in 2.5 years, and industry insiders say it's not a matter of if, but when Georgia will go along with the rest of the country. In Atlanta, I'm Susanna Capoluto for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by America's Family Physicians, offering patient-centered care so employees can better manage their health and employers better manage their costs. AAFP.org/value. By Clarkson Potter's The Splendid Table's How to Eat Supper, the cookbook inspired by the radio program for people who love to eat, available April 8th. And by Putnam Investments, offering more of what you want in a retirement plan. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note, the Aviation Maintenance Watch continues. The Federal Aviation Administration said today it's investigating four U.S. carriers for failing to comply with regulations. The FAA is not saying which airlines it's looking into, but Southwest, Delta, American, and United have been in the news the past week or so for maintenance-related cancellations. In other news of the airborne sort, Boeing and Airbus could have new competition. Wired News reports the Chinese government has launched a company called China Commercial Aircraft. Look for the first planes there by 2020. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. On this Wednesday, the Dow lost 45 points, a third of 1%. The Nasdaq dropped a point, basically flat. The S&P 500 shook off 2 points. That's a tenth of 1%. Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Eric Johnson, Jeff Peters, Aaron Scott, and Phil Stearns engineered the program for us. Coming up next time, close calls for a cargo captain in Dubai.
Around 10 a.m., helicopter comes, and he screams out for the helicopter. And nothing, they don't see them because there's water everywhere. And his friend, Hassan, started getting cold and started getting scared.
It's the latest installment of our series, Working. I'm Kai Rizdal. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.